Corona House had never been designed as a prison, but as the Governor General's residence. As such, it had no holding cells, but a good number of guest suites and state apartments. The smaller rooms more or less resembled conventional hotel rooms, and it was in these that the Human League was confining its New Republic prisoners. There were no bars on the windows, and the beds were furnished with linens. Now that night had fallen, Leia and Mara planned to take advantage of both these features. Step one had already been accomplished. They had stripped the sheets and blankets off both beds, sliced them into strips using a butter knife from Leia's dinner tray, and tied the strips together to form a very crude rope. Step two was a bit trickier. There are ways to smash out a window quietly, but they are not foolproof. They needed to get the window open, but it wouldn't be easy. The guards had spot-welded all the windows on the floor shut. At least they had more or less done so. They had done a proper job on one of Leia's windows, but the weld on the other was downright sloppy. But it was stronger than it looked. First Mara, and then Leia, and then Mara tried to wedge the butter knife into the seam between window frame and sill. Leia was just about ready to give up and risk smashing the window when something went snap and the weld cracked clean in half. Leia gave Mara a grin and slid the window open. It was the work of a moment to gouge a hole in the screen and tear it up. They tied one end of the improvised rope around the bed frame. Leia tied an improvised climbing harness onto herself, snaked the rope through it, climbed up onto the windowsill, and threw the end of the rope out the window. "Wish me luck," she said to Mara. "Oh, I do. After all, I get to go next." Leia swallowed hard and stepped out onto the ledge. The night was cool and clear, and the steady wind caught at her hair. The city of Coronet was spread out below her, directly below her if she looked down, which she chose not to do. She gave the rope a good hard tug. It seemed to be holding. She paused just a moment and put her weight on it as she eased her way over the window ledge. So far, so good. Leia moved slowly, carefully down the wall. She paused when her feet were just about at the top of the 17th floor window. Pushing off against the wall, she walked herself over to one side of the window, trying to avoid both being seen and walking on the glass. A gust of wind blew in from the opposite direction of the steady breeze. It lasted only a few seconds, but it seemed to blow right through her clothing, chilling her to the bone and blowing her hair into her face, blinding her. She shoved it aside with one of her stiff, cold hands. Leia looked down at the window ledge coming up below her. Almost there. Almost there. To her relief, the window shades were drawn. She reached the ledge and was much relieved to put her feet down on something solid, if only for a moment. She flexed her frozen fingers and stepped backwards off the window ledge. Almost immediately, she realized something was wrong. The rope was stretching, sagging under her weight with every step she took. That was not good, not good at all. If it stretched enough, if one crucial bit of thread snapped under the strain, and that opened a wider tear, then... Leia looked down, straight down, and instantly wished that she hadn't. Never mind, never mind. If only she had developed her Jedi skills the way Luke had. If she had, she probably could have simply walked down the side of the building, carrying Mara in one hand and swinging her lightsaber in the other. A little gross exaggeration, of course, but never mind. As things were, she knew that her skills were too undeveloped to put much faith in them at a time like this. Gradually, she worked her way down to the 16th floor the hard way. If her suspicions were correct, this was where the Human League guards had their barracks. She glanced toward the window and counted at least four troopers asleep on their Imperial Army Standard Issue surplus cots. Leia took a deep breath and moved on. Quiet. Care. Slow movements. She went over the next ledge, down to the 15th floor level, the VIP level. A double-high floor to give the residents therein very high, grand ceilings. She paused after she got over the last ledge and breathed a sigh of relief when she saw that virtually all the windows were blown out, drapes billowing out into the wind. That was the good news. It would be easy to get in. The bad news was that she had forgotten that the double-high ceilings meant it was twice as far down to the window ledge. They had made their rope as long as they possibly could, but she had no idea if it would reach down a whole extra story. Suddenly, Leia's foot slipped, and she was swinging through the air, bouncing off the building. She dropped a half meter or so as the rope cleared some snag on one of the ledges above. Leia scrambled as best she could and finally steadied herself against the building. There, directly below her, was a smashed-out window. She slid down the rope. The drapes of the blown-out window billowed below her, and she kicked them out of the way as best she could, but they simply blew back into her. She kicked them back again, and then again, and then she was past them, just in time to be blinded again by her own hair. And then her foot hit the ledge. Never had Leia so welcomed the jolt of pain. She was down. She shoved the drapes out of the way and stepped through the broken window onto the windowsill. She slid the rope out from her climbing harness and pulled on it three times, signaling that she had arrived safely. She looked up, watching for Mara. The rope was gyrating more and more vigorously as Mara came closer. In a surprisingly short time, Mara herself appeared, coming over the last of the ledges, moving well. Down she came. She paused just over the top of the smashed window and looked down. Leia, I've got to get down fast. Spot me. Had something gone wrong? The rope was clearly stretching more and more. Down Mara came, her expression grim and intense. Leia guided her in through the broken window. That climb sure takes it out of you, Mara said. They made their way through the dark suite to the central lobby for the floor. Then Leia led Mara to the apartment that had been her home not so long ago. The furniture had been thrown about and the windows had been smashed to bits. Leia went straight to the kitchen and knelt down by the main cooking unit. There was a storage cabinet under the cooker's heating compartment. She opened it up and pulled the pots and pans out as quietly as she could until she found what she was looking for. Two cloth-wrapped packages. One package was wrapped in the finest black velvet, tied with a silver ribbon. That one she opened first. Her lightsaber, a gift from Luke. He had given it to her just before they left on this trip. She clipped the lightsaber to her belt. The other object, wrapped in a scrap from one of Han's old shirts, was his spare blaster. Take it, Leia whispered. Mara answered, Are you sure you want me at your back with this thing? No more than you want me at your back with my lightsaber, said Leia. But we can get back to not trusting each other later. Right now isn't the time. Take it.
Anybody there?
Mara and Leia froze. The voice, a bit sleepy, was coming from inside the apartment. Suddenly, Leia's heart was pounding in her chest.
Clarvald, is that you?
The voice seemed to be coming from the upper level of the apartment, from the bedrooms. Obviously, at least a few of the Human League troops had found themselves better billets than surplus Imperial Army cots. Leia looked toward Mara and put a finger to her lips. Mara nodded, but held her hand out flat at shoulder level and then brought it down slowly. Duck down. Hide. They were trapped. Han Solo watched as the vibroblade came up through the stone floor and with a high-pitched squeal began slicing out a perfectly circular slab. The vibroblade withdrew, and the slab of stone rose up until it was hanging in midair, a half-meter over the open hole, a portable anti-grav unit attached to its underside. A Salonian hand reached up out of the hole and shoved the slab to one side. A Salonian head popped up out of the hole and nodded cheerfully at Drachmas.
We're glad to have located the proper cell. It caused some awkwardness when we detected that you had been moved. It is of no consequence, but let us be on our way.
She turned toward Han.
Come, Anad Solo. We must go.
Han hesitated. He had no idea what the sides in this fight were, let alone whose side Drachmas was on. Was he being rescued, or just becoming someone else's hostage? He went down the hole. Leia crouched deeper into shadow.
Larva?
The voice was closer. Leia turned to Mara and realized that Mara was not there anymore. There was a bump from the main room, and the shifting shadows in the kitchen told Leia that the beam of the man's hand light was sweeping across the room.
Hold it! I've got a blaster trained right on you, and...
The light of a blaster shot flared, illuminating the kitchen like a bolt of lightning. Leia switched her lightsaber on and rushed out of the kitchen, and stopped dead as she saw the scene lit by the blood-red glow of the blade. There was a heavy-set man, or at least the remains of one, sitting up on the stairs in his nightshirt, a neat hole through his chest.
He dropped the hand light and broke it.
Mara was clearly irritated. We could have used that. That's all you've got to say? That's all there's time for, if we want to live through this. If it makes you feel better, I was going to try and knock him out, not shoot him, until he claimed to have a gun. Using Leia's lightsaber for illumination, they picked their way through the broken furniture and heaps of discarded loot and made their way to the stairs. Even here, the looting troopers had discarded whatever they could not use. A broken desk lamp, a flurry of papers scattered about, a vase, a hat, a comm link rendered useless by the jamming the Human League had imposed. Psst. Leia turned around and saw Mara holding a finger to her lips. She pointed to her ear. Listen. Leia could hear wind moaning through the building. Rain, she mouthed. Mara shook her head, pointed at the lightsaber, and put a finger to her lips again. Leia shut off the lightsaber to silence its low hum. Then she heard it very faint coming from up above. Male voices speaking in harsh, urgent tones, and the shuffle of men hurrying about in the background. It was clearly one man giving orders to others. Their escape had been discovered. Leia switched the lightsaber back on, and the two of them hurried faster down the stairs. At the 12th floor, Leia grabbed the door handle and pulled hard. It didn't budge. She pulled again. Nothing. Had it been welded shut by the League? Had the explosions jammed the door shut? No way to tell. And no time to examine the door for clues. Not when the Human League troops were going to start searching for them any second now. Leia swung the lightsaber down hard in a carefully aimed vertical cut. Down the latch side of the door. She gave it a good solid kick. And it swung open. Leia and Mara stepped through, and Mara pulled the door shut. The lightsaber cuts on the door would provide a clue that even a Human Leaguer could read, but maybe, just maybe, no one would think to look. If the equivalent space on the 15th floor had been a mess, this foyer was barely there anymore. A major explosion had left boulder-sized chunks of stresscrete wall and floor lying everywhere. Most of the doors had been wrenched partly or completely off their hinges. Virtually every window was shattered, and the wind was howling through. The smell of cold rain seemed to speak to Leia of wet, miserable nights and trouble yet to come. There was another, worse smell. The sickly sweet smell of rotting flesh. People had died here when that rocket hit. They were buried here, somewhere in the dark under the debris that had killed them. But if the ghastly scene was affecting Mara, she did not show it.
My room is this way.
In Mara's small suite, the wreckage was caused not by looting, but by the violence of the rocket attack. A big chunk of ceiling had fallen onto the bed, crushing the frame. Broken glass was everywhere. Leia looked toward the window and saw that the rain was coming down in earnest now. The rain flared and pulsed in a dull throb of light as a bolt of lightning flashed. Mara went immediately to the closet and wrenched the door open. The contents spilled out onto the floor, and she knelt down and dug through them until she found a small satchel. She rifled through it until she came up with a hand light. She switched it on, and instantly the weird shadows cast by the lightsaber vanished.
So, where's the slave controller?
Leia asked. Mara set a side table upright and put the hand lamp on it. She pointed to the bed. Under there.
The good news is, it's obvious no one else could have gotten to it. The bad news is that I'm not sure it'll much matter if we can.
You think it might have been crushed? Asked Leia.
One way to find out. Give me a hand clearing the bed off.
Stand back, and let me get the problem down to size first.
Leia swung the lightsaber down, and it slashed through the hunk of stresscrete again and again, chopping it up into smaller pieces. The two women then got their hands under the broken frame and heaved it. The bed came up and a minor avalanche of debris clattered down onto the floor.
Well, we've made enough noise to bring in every Leaguer in the building, Mara said.
Leia held the hand light for Mara. There it was, a neat, flat little metal package taped to the center of the bed frame's underside. Mara pushed the power button, and all the other buttons lit up.
That's something, anyway. At least it thinks it's working.
Leia was about to make some sort of encouraging reply when they heard a bang and a thud and muffled voices. Leia immediately shut off the hand light, and both women ducked behind the upturned bed. The noises came nearer. Leia pulled out her lightsaber once again, her thumb on the switch. Mara shut off the slave controller to extinguish the lights on its control panel.
You check the next room,
one trooper shouted out.
I'll get this one.
They could hear the crunch of his boots on the broken glass, his breathing as he stepped into the room. Mara had her pocket blaster aimed straight at the man's heart as he finished his cursory check. He turned back the way he had come, little realizing that he was staying alive by keeping his back to the upended bed. The trooper headed back out into the hallway, and the two women relaxed, if only a trifle. The trooper or his friends could be back at any moment. Leia tapped Mara on the shoulder and pointed to the smashed-out window. Mara frowned and nodded reluctantly. Neither of them could work up much enthusiasm for standing on a narrow ledge in the middle of a rainstorm, but they were running out of places to go. The trouble started the moment Leia stepped out on the rain-swept ledge and moved toward the left side of the window, trying to get out of sight of the room. The rain instantly soaked her to the bone. Leia put her back to the wall, grabbed onto one of the sodden drapes flapping through the window with her left hand, and held tight. When Mara came out onto the ledge, she slipped, and Leia caught her just in time. Mara twisted awkwardly, catching her left calf on a jagged piece of glass in the process. She grabbed at Leia and hung on for dear life. It took her a moment to compose herself, and then she clambered over Leia to get past her on the ledge. Instantly, she had the controller out, trying to work it in the driving rain. Leia adjusted the hand light so it put out a tight beam and pointed it down at the controller. No good, Mara shouted into Leia's ear. Comlink mode is jammed for sure, and there's not a chance in the galaxy of a laser punching through this storm. We'll just have to wait out in the rain. Leia nodded. Mara turned off the slave controller and shoved it into her satchel. Leia turned off the hand light and tucked it inside her blouse. Suddenly, the wall of rain in front of her bloomed with light coming from the room they had just left. Someone was back in there looking around. Leia held her lightsaber at the ready. Anyone who came out that window was going to pay dearly for doing so. But then the light went away. Another reprieve. And suddenly the rain was fading away, the line of squalls passing over Coronet and moving on to other business elsewhere on the coast. Leia looked to Mara, but she already had the slave controller back out and powered up. Positive lock, Mara said, looking back toward Leia. And then behind Leia, a human League trooper had his head out the window and was bringing his blaster to bear. Leia had the lightsaber up over her head for a downward strike before she was finished. The trooper fired, and she deflected the shot with her lightsaber. She swung the blade around for an uppercut that chopped through the trooper's blaster before it sliced his head off at the neck. A hand appeared, threw a mini detonator toward Leia, and then vanished. Leia caught the detonator on her lightsaber blade and flipped it back in toward the building. It went off a split second later, with enough force to have blown her off the ledge if she hadn't grabbed at the drapery again. A gout of flame spewed out the window, close and hot enough to singe her hair. They were running out of time and chances and choices with alarming speed. Leia looked toward where the spaceport was, off toward the horizon. There it was. She could see it, a spot of light headed straight for them at high speed. Jade Spire, rushing closer. But there behind it were other dots of light rising from the spaceport, pocket patrol boats sent to chase down the ship that had suddenly launched itself. Leia, Mara shouted. Get ready. The second she's close enough, jump. The Fire, a graceful craft with a snubbed-off nose and wide fuselage, slowed as it came nearer. Mara brought her in to a complete halt in midair, about 50 meters from the ledge. A blaster fired from one of the upper windows of Corona House. The shot pinged off the Fire's hull. A door opened in the top of the fuselage. A gun turret popped out and immediately swiveled about and returned fire. Mara began sidling the Fire in closer toward Corona House. Leia looked down at the port side wing of the big ship and judged the distance to be about 2 meters. A meter and a half. Close enough. She jumped. She heard a bump on the hull behind her and hoped it was Mara, but there was no time to look back. She jumped down the hatch, not worrying about how she was going to land, interested only in getting hull metal between herself and the line of fire. She pulled herself up just as Mara came swarming down the hatch ladder, blood soaking through the left leg of her coverall. Mara half lunged, half fell into the pilot station and instantly powered up the shields. That'll hold the pocket patrol boats, Mara said. She hit the throttle, and the Jade Spire leapt forward, grabbing for speed and altitude.
Gariel Captison sat down at the one end of the long table and nodded to the man standing at the far end.
Admiral, I think we're ready to begin.
Thank you, Madam Captison.
Admiral Hortel Ocelage of the Bakuran Navy looked around at their visitors, Luke, Lando, and Belindi Kalenda. He turned to Luke.
Mr. Skywalker, I wish to review this situation. How long until your new republic can refit and redeploy its ships in order to assemble a fleet of its own?
Our best estimate is that massing a force and preparing for action will take another 45 standard days. Ocelage raised his eyebrows.
Indeed. Mr. Skywalker, I begin to wonder how you won against the Empire.
Ocelage was a small man of slight build, well-scrubbed and pink-skinned, completely bald, but sporting a dramatic pair of bushy black eyebrows and a sharply pointed goatee. In a day and a half of talks, Ocelage had demonstrated that his was a first-class mind, and that he had little time for nonsense of any sort.
Our military readiness is very low, Luke explained, but we have good evidence that the plotters on Corellia have penetrated our security system and timed their operation carefully.
In short, they caught you with your pants down.
Ocelage turned toward Kalenda.
Lieutenant Kalenda, once more, please, your best estimate of the enemy's naval strength.
Sir, I am forced to report that from all I could see, the naval strength of the Human League and their allies is almost negligible. They seem to have a large number of fighter craft and corvette-class craft, but nothing bigger. That's the evidence, but I think it would be suicidal to take that information at face value. We have to assume that they are hiding their strength.
Doesn't your outfit keep track of that sort of thing?
Lando asked.
Kalenda shrugged. The NRI does its best to track ship inventories, but it's almost impossible. And it's hard to get the information you have to the people who need it. We've got agents all over the outlier worlds, but their intelligence reports would go through Coruscant before they were sent on here. The fact that we can't use hyperwave is slowing things down quite a bit. The reports haven't caught up with me yet. Maybe a courier ship will bring all sorts of news tomorrow, but even if it does, I wouldn't put much stock in the information. The galaxy is pretty big. You can hide whole fleets full of ships or whole shipyards without much trouble. And there's an awful lot of surplus hardware from the Republic Empire war floating around.
Very well, Ocelage said. It would appear I already know all I am going to know. I would call upon Madam Captison to discuss the political side of the situation before we discuss the military side.
Luke looked toward Gariel, along with everyone else at the table. It is fairly straightforward. The Prime Minister and the government have ordered the Navy to assist the New Republic in this crisis and authorized the Admiral to lead a task force for the relief of Corellia.
Wonderful, Luke said. Please convey our thanks to the Prime Minister.
You are all most welcome. And it goes without saying that all Bakura will be proud to repay some part of the great debt we owe the New Republic. There is one other matter. While Admiral Ocelage will be in full military command of the operation, the Prime Minister has appointed me as her plenipotentiary, with full powers to speak for Bakura in matters of policy. She felt this would be necessary because the communications jamming would render normal consultations with Bakura impossible.
But, Madam Captison, Luke objected, what of your child?
Malinza will stay with family here, of course. I am not the first parent called to hazardous duty.
Yes, of course. Luke wanted to object to the idea of Gariel going along, but he knew he wouldn't win the argument.
Thank you for your concern, Jedi Master, Gariel said. Admiral, I think it best that we turn to you and discuss the practicalities of the mission.
Yes, ma'am. I believe we can get in, locate the interdiction field generator, and knock it out, opening the door to whatever New Republic forces can be mustered in the meantime. And I believe we can do this without being unduly inconvenienced ourselves by the Corellian field.
How so? Lando asked.
We believe we have developed a partial countermeasure to the interdiction field.
Ocelage held up his hand to the eager questions from Luke, Lando, and Kalenda.
As you know, an interdiction field simulates the mass lines produced by a naturally occurring gravity well. We have spent some time developing a device called a hyperwave inertial momentum sustainer, or hyperwave sustainer.
It uses a gravitic sensor that provides a fast cutoff for a ship's normal hyperdrive, causing it to shut off instantly before it can be damaged by the interdiction field. At the same time, it activates a static hyperspace bubble produced by a hyperspace coil designed to burn up and blow out in the presence of an interdiction field. The bubble can hold the ship in hyperspace while the ship's forward momentum carries it along. The first blowout coil activates the second activates the third, and so on. In effect, the ship flickers in and out of hyperspace, jumping into it and being thrown back out of it over and over again until its forward momentum carries it clear of the interdiction field.
Very elegant, Luke said, impressed.
We have at present only 4 ships, Ocelage went on, 3 destroyers and 1 light cruiser equipped with the system, but it will allow us to drop within close striking distance of Salonia.
Salonia? Lando said.
We figured out the interdiction field generator had to be somewhere in the double planet system, somewhere on Talus or Tralis. Why go to Salonia? Because Salonia provides us with a target of opportunity and a diversion from our attack on the double worlds. Let me show you.
He pushed a series of buttons on the control panel by his hand. The room light dimmed, and a standard wireframe schematic of the Corellian planetary system appeared, floating over the center of the table.
These are the current relative positions of the 5 inhabited planets of the Corellian system. As you can see, Corellia is on the opposite side of the star Corell from Tralis and Talus. Dral is about 90 degrees ahead of Corellia, but Salonia is nearly at its closest approach to the double planets. As you can also see, its orbit is exterior to that of the double planets. If we make a direct approach to Tralis and Talus, we have to pass by Salonia. And Salonia is a major target. The rebels there will be forced to defend it.
If there are rebels there, Luke said, we know almost nothing about what's going on there.
I am not sure there are any rebels anywhere,
Ocelage said.
Simultaneous uprisings by independent groups on 5 worlds? That's stretching the bounds of credulity. I believe there is a more intimate relationship between the various rebellions. I do not wish to speculate further just at the moment, but in regard to your point, Mr. Skywalker, one reason I wish to mount an assault at Salonia is to find out what will happen. We can learn from their reaction to us. If they welcome us as liberators, all to the good. If, on the other hand, they attack, as I suspect they will, we will no doubt learn a great deal, and we will compel them to commit their short-range forces. I hope that by drawing them out at Salonia, we can weaken the forces they can mass at Tralis and Talus.
Lando looked over the tactical display.
It makes a certain amount of sense, but it's risky. Extremely risky.
Ocelage faded out the tactical display and brought the room lights back up.
Audacity is a weapon that must be drawn from its scabbard from time to time.
Luke Skywalker said nothing, but he was coming to realize just how dangerous a man Ocelage was. The question was, dangerous to whom?
Han Solo crawled behind Drachmas down the tunnel, bone-weary of the journey and wearier still of not knowing what was going on. It had been 2 days since the Salonians had rescued them from the Human League's hidden fortress. The rescue party had escorted them out of the escape tunnel to a main passageway and then said their goodbyes. Han and Drachmas had been traveling ever since, through a seemingly endless series of low-ceilinged tunnels, lit in the gloomiest, dimmest red imaginable.
Is it much farther to some place I can stand up?
Han asked, raising his voice a bit so Drachmas could hear him. She was ahead of him in the tunnel, as she had been for most of the journey. Han had spent an awful lot of time the last few days watching her hindquarters and tail as she moved ahead of him. Drachmas laughed.
Always you want to stand. Is it not a nice rest to be off your hind feet? Stretch yourself. Let 4 legs do some of the job.
The Salonian hadn't answered his question that time either. He had the distinct impression that she had received instructions from the rescue party to keep quiet and answer no questions. Once or twice Han had considered striking out on his own through the tunnel system, but he knew the idea was hopelessly impractical. Drachmas could move through the tunnels a lot faster than he could, for one thing. And she knew her way around the tunnel system, for another. And she could call for an awful lot of help, if need be. Han and she were far from alone down here.
The Duchess Marcia of Mastagophorus and her nephew Ibrahim stayed up late talking about recent strange and disturbing events. Aunt Marcia was interested to hear about the archaeological dig on Corellia that Ibrahim had visited with the children and their parents, and more interested still in the strange secret chamber Anakin had found deep in the ground.
"Nephew," she said, "have you ever heard of an archaeological dig on Drow?"
Ibrahim frowned.
"Of course not. That was part of why I was so interested in seeing one. There's no such thing as Drawlish archaeology."
"That," said Marcia, "was my impression."
The Drawl were a tidy people and an ancient one, much given to keeping good records and keeping things organized. For thousands of years, everything of importance had either been neatly filed away in storage or else recycled. She continued,
"That is why it surprised me to see a brief mention in the press recently of a large archaeological project near the equator."
"That's absurd."
"I quite agree. I found it peculiar enough that I tried to learn more. I was able to establish the location of the dig, but that was all. What intrigues me is that the account of the dig made it sound a great deal like the one you described."
Ibrahim looked at his aunt in open-mouthed astonishment.
"Aunt Marcia, the implications of what you are saying..."
"I know, I know. I don't see that we have any choice but to pursue the question. I think you had best tell me more about what the children discovered."
Han had lost all track of time. He could hardly believe there had been a time when he had not been crawling behind Drachmas through the endless network of Low Salonian tunnels. On and on they went, moving at a snail's pace. Now and again they would come to a larger passage, sometimes merely wide enough for two Salonians to walk side by side, sometimes a vast artificial cavern. Han was glad to see any such place, so long as the ceiling was high enough for him to stand upright. Even if he was no longer capable of standing, the endless hours of crawling in the cramped tunnels had left him hunched over, his back aching, his knees so battered and sore he could barely straighten them. But even tottering along stiff-legged with stabbing pain shooting through his back was preferable to crawling. Nor was there anything private about his ordeal. Any chamber large enough to hold large numbers of Salonians was doing exactly that. They were busily working on bits of machinery Han could not quite identify, carrying things back and forth, talking and arguing and shouting and laughing together in both the standard Salonian Han had learned and a special code of whistles and hoots. Everywhere he went, they watched him, all eyes locked on the strange apparition from the upper world. One huge chamber was close to the size of an underground town, and a crowded one at that. There seemed to be a number of badly injured Salonians in the throng, several of them laid out on stretchers. Some wore bloody bandages, and under the general hubbub of crowd noises, Han could hear a high-pitched keening, a cry that was past all hope of help or relief. Even those who seemed uninjured looked lost and afraid.
"Who are they?" Han asked.
"Refugees,"
Drachmas said, her voice hard-edged and angry. No matter what order she had about answering questions, she could not restrain herself from speaking now.
"Refugees of the making of your cousin Salsullo and his human league. Their surface homes burned, gas bombs in their tunnels, chased and hunted and shot at. My people suffer because Thrakan Salsullo, a human of your blood, says they must, and for no other reason. Come, honored Solo. We must keep moving. The end is near, but time is short."
The end is near. There was a phrase with unpleasant connotations. Han stumbled forward. Luke Skywalker stepped into the courtyard gardens of Garriel Captison's home and sat quietly on the bench that faced the marker stone. Beneath it, as he had learned, were the ashes of Garriel's dead husband. It was hard for him not to look at that stone, not to think about the man it commemorated. But events had been as they were. There was nothing to be done about it. Now, on the morning of leave-taking, it was time to move on. He heard a sound behind him, stood up and turned around. There they were, coming down the stairs to the garden. Gariel and her daughter, Malinza. The little girl had her mother's deep, luxuriant black hair and long black tresses that hung down her back. She was pale-skinned, with serious-looking brown eyes. Malinza, Gariel said, I want you to meet a very special friend of mine. He's going with me on my trip. Malinza looked up at Luke.
Hello. Are you going along to take care of my mommy?
Luke knelt down in front of the child. The time he had spent with Leia's children had taught him a few things. He knew that some questions needed to be turned on their side if you wanted to understand what a child was really thinking. Malinza was a little worried about who would take care of her while her mommy was gone. I'm not going along to take care of her, but I will watch out for her. But even if your mother has to go away for a while, she'd never do it if she didn't make sure someone was here to take care of you. Gariel knelt down next to her daughter and gave her a pat on the shoulder. That's right, Malinza. Madame Bobo will stay with you, and Lady Corwell will come by every single day to make sure everything is all right. Malinza thought for a moment and then nodded.
All right. But you watch out for her like you promised.
I will, said Luke. I will. Lady Tendra Rizant's ship, the Gentleman Caller, moved in toward Corellia at a leisurely pace. Tendra checked the radionic transmitter for the 100th time. It was a strange old system Lando had given her when he and Luke had been abruptly ordered off Sikoria. He told her they could keep in touch by using it. The system transmitted and received modulated electromagnetic radiation in the radio band of the spectrum. Your recorded voice went out as modulations on a radio band carrier signal, shot out into the universe at the speed of light. It seemed to be working. All the indicator lights were showing green, and the message repeater was definitely sending out her hailing call over and over again. She had checked that enough times.
Tendra to Lando, she heard herself say over the speaker. Please respond on pre-assigned frequency. Tendra to Lando, please respond on pre-assigned frequency.
The message repeated itself ad infinitum, but it had been days now, and there had been no response. Lando had told her that the radionic unit aboard the Lady Luck was always on, always scanning for messages, so why hadn't he answered yet? Tendra was getting to be a galaxy-class expert on waiting and worrying. The Solonian tunnels got longer, bigger, and much less crowded as Han and Drachmas crawled on. Han began to hear low mechanical sounds, then voices, Solonian voices, calling to each other. He hurried along behind Drachmas down a long ramp that opened onto a chamber of metal and gleaming plastic, echoing with rush and bustle. It was a transportation hub, that much was obvious. A pocket-sized landing field stood at its center, with three small spacecraft sitting on it, maintenance crews working on them. The ceiling of the place was a retractable dome. A bullet train sat on its track, ready to hurtle down the rail tunnel that came through one wall of the chamber and back out another. Quite a place, was all Han could think to say.
There are many like it, Drachmas said. It is like all the others.
That surprised Han. But I thought that you just walked in the tunnels.
Why think that? Do you not think Salonians can build their own machines and vehicles? We are just ignorant primitives who live underground without help from our fine human friends.
All right. I wasn't thinking. My apologies. Who knows about this place besides the Salonians?
You do. No one else.
Exactly the answer I was hoping not to get. Drachmas led Han to the largest of the three spacecraft. He knew at a glance that it had not come out of any of the human-operated Corellian shipyards. The design was crude in many ways, but simple and effective. It had to be that the Salonians had built it themselves. While Han was looking over the ship, a hatch popped open and a boarding ladder extended down to the ground. A peppery, energetic-looking Salonian climbed down the ladder and came over to Drachmas and Han. She grinned at Han and gave a hissing laugh.
So, this is the Boltskin I've heard about,
she said in Salonian that was almost too fast for Han to follow.
Not much to look at, is she?
A he, Drachma said mildly. This one is a male, young Salkrut. And he has been through many a privation, many injuries, and much difficulty. That he is here to look at all, says much about him.
Han was more than a little surprised to hear Drachmas offer any praise of him.
Is most kind of you to saying so, honored Drachmas, he said in his somewhat labored Salonian.
Drachmas said,
I must consult with certain others before we depart. Pilot Salkold will watch over you while I am away.
She gave a shallow bow to Han and a deeper one to Salkold and went on her way. Han pointed to himself and said in Salonian,
Am pilot have own ship. Can you show me yours?
Salkold looked at him quizzically.
You're a pilot, huh? They never told me that. Sure. I'll show you around.
As they ranged about the ship, it did not take Han long to realize that his initial impression was correct. The ship had been built here by Salonians. Practically everything aboard fit into one of two categories. First, general-purpose hardware bought off the shelf, a sort of thing that was widely available as new, as used, as surplus, or even as scrap. Things like the boarding ladder, or the pilot's chair, or the power couplings. Second, there was the specialized gear, either modified from its original use or custom-made. Everything in the second category replaced something that would be easy to trace if purchased on the open market, or the black market. The Navicomputer and the Boostland repulsor units, for example, were clearly hand-built, and no one hand-built those if they did not have to. That piece of information told him a great deal. The human-run Corellian shipyards were among the most famous in the galaxy, and rightly so. The Millennium Falcon, or at least the stock freighter that had become the Falcon after a few thousand modifications, had been built there. Han knew that ships, and second-hand ships more capable than this one, were cheap and easy to come by. So why go to all the trouble and expense to build one's own vehicles, inferior to what you could buy cheaper? There was really only one explanation, and Han did not like it. You built your own ships when you didn't want anyone to know what you were doing. He was in among the rebels. Honored Salkold, he asked, struggling to speak his best Salonian. Who are all of you? What is going on? Salkold looked surprised at this question.
No one has told you this?
No one.
We are the Han Chuzuk, then. We wish Salonians on Corellia to be free.
Free of what? The New Republic? The Human League?
What? No. What concerns of ours are those? We wish to be free of the Overden, the central power on Salonia. And you are part of the plan.
But what is my part?
We take you to Salonia, of course. We will trade you to the Overden.
The air car drifted down out of the Dralin sky and settled in behind a convenient crag. Everyone piled out as quietly as possible. It was a cold and windy night, particularly cruel to furless humans. Ebrahim sent the children back into the air car, while the two Drawl adults reconnoitered and Chewbacca got the sounder and digger ready, assisted, or perhaps harassed, by Q-9. After they realized that the archaeological digs on Corellia and Drawl had so much in common, Aunt Marcia and Ebrahim had asked the children to describe the strange chamber they had found. At first, the children were reluctant to share their secrets, but when Ebrahim told them that the future of the whole New Republic might depend on it, they described what they had seen in detail. Now, everyone was going to find the Drawlin chamber, or so they hoped.
I believe we are in the right spot,
Aunt Marcia said.
I took all the tracking information from Q-9's movements through the tunnel system on Corellia.
Just then the ground shook. Chewbacca had the sounder up and running. After getting readings from four or five different points on the surface, he had enough data to put together a reasonably clear three-dimensional infrared map of the subsurface. Then he set up the borer and checked the hookup one last time. Ibrahim listened carefully and nodded.
I understand. If anyone is watching in infrared or listening, they will be able to spot us very easily. I will have the air car at the ready and be in the pilot's chair prepared to take off at a moment's notice.
Chewbacca nodded. The sound was remarkably loud, even inside the air car.
That thing is really kicking out some power, said Jason, climbing up into the front seat of the air car to get a better look.
Anakin crawled into his brother's lap.
Chewie's got the blaster matrix focus too tight, he said, frowning.
How do you know that?
Asked Ibrahim, who had joined the children to escape the noise.
I don't know. But I guess it's working okay, anyway.
Anakin looked out the window and seemed to be calculating something in his head.
It ought to take about 20 minutes.